This is lecture number three in the series that Britain since the Romans. We're going to talk about the high and the late Middle Ages. The Middle Ages that you say in French, le Moyen Âge. On se demande pourquoi, où est-il comment, où est-il moyen? It's a bit strange idea to call them the Middle Ages, the middle between what and what. There is no exact dates for the beginning of the Middle Ages, but traditionally the Middle Ages, notice that the Middle Ages is a concept for Europe. You can't talk about the Middle Ages in China, it doesn't make sense, yeah? The Middle Ages is after the Roman Empire and before the Renaissance. The Renaissance was the rediscovery of the ideas of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. In the Renaissance, they rediscovered Pythagoras, Plato, Socrates, and their friends. So for many years, these ideas were lost. They were saved by two countries. First of all, in Ireland, the monks in Ireland, in the monasteries in Ireland. And secondly, in the north of Africa, where Plato and Aristotle were translated into Arabic and maintained, yeah? So Europe lost the ideas, but two countries were keeping them. So, the high and the late Middle Ages. Last week, I spoke about the invasions, which is the beginning of the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages. So the high and late Middle Ages. 1066, the Norman invasion, the invasion by William the Conqueror, the last time that Britain was invaded. And 1485... Why not? You have to choose a date. And 1485 is the end of the War of the Roses. C'est la fin de la guerre des deux roses. On dit en anglais the War of the Roses, et non pas the War of the Two Roses, même qu'il y en avait effectivement que deux. And the beginning of the Reformation, which I will be talking about the next time I see you. Notice the little notice I put up there. I will not be here next week. The university is sending me to Birmingham to negotiate something important. I don't know what. So I won't be here next week. So let's get on to these Middle Ages then. 1066. Let's have a look at the map here. In 1066, William the Conqueror... wandered into Britain and invaded. How was this possible? Well, first of all, the reason was the King of England died, and there were three different people who could say, I should be king now. And one of them was William of Normandy, Guillaume, and he had some family link with the English king, and so he could say, oh, I'm the perfect person to be king. And he had an extra argument, because he arrived with an army. And he defeated Harold, who was the other person who wanted to be king. He defeated Harold at the Battle of Hastings. And famously, Harold got an arrow in his eye and died. If you are ever in Bayeux, up somewhere up there near Caen, there is the Bayeux tapestry, La Tapisserie de Bayeux, which tells the story, is the original from 1066, which tells the story of the invasion. And it's a very impressive document. So here we are, Normandy, William the Conqueror arrives in Britain, and he is successful. So why is he successful? I keep repeating myself, why is the only interesting question. Why is he successful? The technology was better. William's technology was better, in particular the archers. The French archers were the best. I'm not quite sure why. The exact technology of the French archers were the best. Maybe they still are. And so he arrived in Britain, and he was also lucky. Notice that many of William's soldiers, they were not necessarily Norman nationalists. Many of them were fighting for money. They were mercenaries. They were fighting for money. Now, the good thing from when you are a king, the good thing about mercenaries is they are very good, they're very professional, very good at their job. The bad thing about mercenaries is that if you lose a battle, they go and ask the opposition if they can have a job. Yeah, so it's all a bit dangerous. Try not to use mercenaries if you're invading, okay? Right, okay, so William arrived in Britain, and he had a certain amount of difficulty conquering the whole country. There were a number of rebellions. In particular, the most famous rebellion was led by a gentleman. I don't know if it was a gentleman or not, but Hereward the Wake was the leader of one of the rebellions against So you can go and look in Wikipedia what they say about Herod the Wake. It's probably true. Yeah. Wikipedia is very useful for ancient history. Personne va s'amuser à écrire des mensonges sur un roi du 11e siècle. So for that kind of subject, Wikipedia is very good. Yeah. If you look in Wikipedia about Palestine and Israel today, it's much more difficult because people don't agree. Yeah. But Wikipedia is very good for old history. So William the Conqueror continues conquering the north. He moves north very slowly, and in particular, there is an episode known as the Harrying of the North. I love this expression, which is a classic euphemism. The Harrying of the North, donc littéralement le harcèlement du Nord. Il est allé au Nord, il les a harcelés. C'est-à-dire qu'il les a tous tués, quoi. Brûler les villes, des trucs comme ça. Ils savaient harceler dans le temps. Hein. Ça, c'est du vrai harcèlement. Pas comme les petites qu'ils font aujourd'hui. OK. So that's what he did, most important thing, William then gave the land. He conquered the land, and he gave the land to the French aristocrats who came with him. Notice then that it's a very different kind of invasion from the Roman invasion or the Viking invasion or the Saxon invasion, because William arrived with 6,000 soldiers. Yeah, only 6,000 soldiers. It's a lot at the time, but it's not enormous. However, they were very persuasive soldiers. very quickly, a few years later, a quarter of the country's land was owned by 11 men, and none of them spoke English. And in general, the elite, the Anglo-Saxon elite, was replaced by the French aristocracy, the Norman aristocracy, and for hundreds of years, the elite spoke French, and the ordinary people spoke English. In fact, for hundreds of years, the King of England did not speak English. He could not speak English. It was not a priority for him. They rapidly introduce big changes. And one of the most important changes is the Norman legal system, which is very different indeed from the Anglo-Saxon thing. First of all, bad news for if any of the women here, if you are rich women, this is bad news for you, because before the Norman invasion, you could have your lands, and now only men can own lands. That's not very fair, is it? There you go. The other big change is that under the Norman legal system, all of the land in the country belongs to the king. All of the land belongs to the king, and the king will let you use it. You're the Duke of York, okay? I will allow you to use the land and profit from the land if you send me 300 soldiers every year to fight for me. Yeah? Deal? Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, so this is the system that everything belongs to the king. The king is, c'est l'État, c'est moi, hein? c'est vraiment ça, comme dirait l'autre plus tard. Now, the Normans, although they were very violent, yeah, the harrying of the north, were very, very serious stuff, at the same time, they certainly brought technical progress in a quite spectacular manner, because the Normans were particularly good at architecture. There's William the Conqueror on the Bayeux tapestry. If you ever get a chance to see it, I don't know if you recognise this building. This is the Tower of London, an important section of it was built in 1066. En attendant, c'est-à-dire, c'était construit par Guillaume le Conquérant, mais je peux vous rassurer, lui, il n'a rien fait du tout. But he organised the building of the Tower of London, which is still standing today. So let's imagine what it was like to be king at this time. You still have the same system as used the Anglo-Saxon kings, that is to say, the king must move around the country in order to make sure there are no revolts. The first priority as the king is to avoid rebellions, because he has a problem. William is king because he won a battle. That's always dangerous, because you might lose the next battle. Yeah? And so you have to work very hard at making friends and isolating your enemies. It's a bit like being a student at Crete. Okay, so that's what he did. Now, every year, the king organized three big feasts, where all the aristocrats, all the important aristocrats came, had a big feast, and this is the beginning, in fact, of the idea of parliaments. Parliament will rise very, very slowly. At the beginning, the aristocrats are invited to a party, every few months. And then afterwards, they expect to be able to give advice to the king. Yeah, and it will move from there. But that for hundreds of years, the job of the parliament is to give advice to the king. The king is the only person who decides for hundreds and hundreds of years. Okay, the church is also tremendously important at this time and very closely linked with the king. Although, of course, this is the Catholic Church. In fact, it was just at the time they just called it the church. It was the only one. And so the Pope had a lot of power. But the king was very much involved with this. So when the Pope wanted a new archbishop, he phoned the king. And that's an old joke now. He phoned the king, and the king decided, yes, I recommend John Smith as the archbishop. Yes, they're very closely together. The other difficulty the king had is that he quite often went to France, not on holiday, not to see the Louvre, but he went to France to fight. Because as you can see, most of France is run by somebody else, the Duke of Burgundy and so on. And so the aim of the English king was to conquer the whole of France. And the problem with going to France is that you might have a rebellion while you're not there. And so he used to leave the kingdom in charge. And the war with France continued for a very, very, very long time. In 1308, in the beginning of the 14th century, there was a particular controversy among the aristocracy because Edward, he left his lover in charge of the kingdom. He went to France to fight and he left his lover in charge of the kingdom. And the aristocracy were not so happy about this because his lover was a man. And so this was considered to be not very medieval. Okay, let's keep looking then at the Normans and the technical advances. And one of the technical advances, important technical advances, a technical advance in government, and that is that the tax system became much more sophisticated. And William organized the writing of this book, the Domesday Book, which is very, very, very boring to read. But historians are very happy. It is a list of every town and village in England with how many animals, how many fish they produce every year, how much tax you can ask for. So it's not very interesting, but historians are very happy because if you want to study Italy or France in 1066, very little information. And here you have all the information you could want, every single village. And there are some very interesting parts of it. For example, every single village, as you can see, would you like to read it? No, never mind. Every village is given information. For example, the entry for one village, it's not very important which village, shows that it was an important fishing town with 3,000 residents. And it gave information, the farmland has been lost to the sea. Yeah. But it also gave information about how much tax every year this village, well this town, 3,000 people is a town, every year this town must pay to the king tax. Every year they must pay 68,000 herrings. 68 mille poissons. That was the tax. Now, this is very important and not surprising. At the time, money was not the normal way of exchanging. There were not many shops yet. Money was not so important. There was money, but that was not the most important thing. Fish, very important. The tremendous advantage of fish is that you can preserve fish in salt or by drying it, so you can eat it all year long. And remember, this is a time when ordinary people don't eat meat in the winter. They kill all the animals in October because it's too expensive to feed them all winter. Obviously, be careful. Don't kill all the animals. You have to keep at least two for next year, yeah? You understand? That's what you're doing, okay. Okay, so that's just a symbol, the tax that they had to pay. Now, at this time, according to the Domesday Book, 10% of the population are slaves. Dipo sunt esclave. This is very important because this shows us that slavery is not the center of the economy. It's important, if you're a slave, it's important that you're a slave. But 10%, so it's not the most important element of the economy. Most of the economy is made up of serfs, that is to say, farmers, who are not allowed to leave their land. That their land does not belong to them, your land belongs to the Lord. And in return for working on the Lord's land, military service, repairing the roads, I will allow you to have some land to feed your family. So a very classic feudal system. A very classic feudal system. You have a choice. If you don't want to be a farmer, you can become a priest or a monk. Or a nun, indeed, if you're a lady. Extremely important. A large number of monks and nuns are around. So that's an important, the Doomsday Book is an important advance in government, an important advance in organization. Of course, they had to work very hard to calculate the taxes that they had to pay. And one of the difficulties that they had, of course, which we wouldn't recognize today, is that if I ask you to calculate the taxes for 12 months, and I tell you that the taxes for, that's the tax for every month, and you could you just multiply this by 12, please? Yeah, you can see the problem. Unfortunately, at the time, we didn't have enough Arabs around, and we had no Arabic numbers. So we only have these numbers. And I don't know if you've ever tried multiplying with these numbers, but it's really very, very difficult indeed. They were short of calculators, short of iPhones, and they had to use the abacus. Je sais qu'en français, on dit le boulier chinois. Je pense qu'il n'est pas chinois, mais bon, you know, avec 10 boules, pas trop de boules. Okay, so let's have a look. Some things about the king. Let's have a look at some of the king's servants. You would have a servant whose responsibility it is to do the hunting. You have to organize the hunting for the food. Another servant had to organize the king's bath every month. It's not a joke. They had a bath every month. Another servant had to dry the king's clothes, the official king's clothes dryer. That's very, very important, of course. It's interesting to see that rich people ate very badly. In fact, rich people tried to eat only meat. And I don't know if you've ever tried eating only meat. It's not good for you. So they had a lot of health problems because they ate only meat. Salt was tremendously important. And very expensive. Why was salt important? Yeah? Yes, to keep the food, yes. Especially the meat, yeah. Yeah, to preserve the meat. Yeah. If you have salt on meat, then you can eat it 6 months later. Yeah. So tremendously, tremendously important. Okay. Now the system was relatively stable. There were not a lot of revolts. Except in Wales, Upi de Gael. This also gives us the chance to look at some of the architecture. I'm not talking about William the Conqueror now, I'm talking about the Norman kings for 300 years. And slowly they managed to conquer Wales, Upi de Gael, and they built a series of castles. Here is Conwy Castle, 1283. Rudlin Castle, 1277. That's also Rudlin Castle. Now, these are castles along the borders between England and Wales, and you can learn a lot from them. First of all, if you build a castle like that, it's not because you feel safe. Yeah? It's because you feel there is a danger. So the Normans from England, they were successful. They won against the Welsh, but they didn't feel very safe, and so they built castles like this. This kind of castle, shall we attack this? Oh, no, let's not attack it. You know, it looks pretty dangerous thing. And of course, when you climb up the walls and then they pour boiling water on your head, it's not very nice, really, not very nice. But tremendous architecture. These pictures are today. Yeah, that says very well survived. Tremendous architecture. But the Normans went much further than that, because the Normans are the in Britain are the gang who had the first cathedrals built. This is York Minster, and in the even today, this would be a very impressive building if somebody built it. At the time, you can imagine the amount of money work that went into the building of a such a building. York Minster was begun in 1080. Begun in 1080, that's the inside, and their Salisbury Cathedral begun in 1220, and that's the inside. So this again a tremendous confidence, I think, in the stability of their system, because so let's spend 150 years building a cathedral. Yeah, it's very solid. Now the Salisbury Cathedral, this last one here, Salisbury Cathedral is the biggest in Europe, along with two others, Köln, Cologne, vous dites, et aussi Seville. Seville are the other ones, yeah. Ils ont construit la cathédrale à Köln, juste à côté de la gare, pour que les touristes puissent le voir facilement. Now, the cathedrals are tremendously important, not just for religion, but also for power. Remember, the power of the church and the power of the king are very close together. And basically, when you see this, well, that's the German one, but when you see the, when you live in a little village and you go to York or to Salisbury once a year, and you see the, whoa, yeah, you're supposed to be intimidated. If you have the luck to go to Albi in the south of France, you have the Cathedral of Albi, which was built after there had been a revolt against the church. And it's a cathedral, you look at it and think, oh no, I'm not revolting. I'm not going to revolt. That's okay, I agree with you. Very, very powerful images. But also, when the ordinary farmer went inside the church, they found the highest technology of the time. The big, important technological changes of the time are the windmill, le moulin avant. Ça, c'est pas dans la cathédrale, mais tous les autres aussi. The clock. The cathedral will be the only place for a long time that you have a clock, and then little by little the church will have a clock. And this is extremely impressive to somebody who's never seen a clock, yeah? So, well, you, well, I can't, where's the sun? Oh, it must be, well, 4:30, I think, yeah? Yeah, etc. You know, you do what you can. So these tremendous clocks, and finally, the organ, l'orgue, is tremendous technology for the people at the time. So it's very important to show the importance of the church and the importance of the of power. And from time to time, you can see conflict here, because you have here a town in the south of England, and this clock was established in 1403. And a historian can find out a lot of things from this, because what is important about this clock, 1403, is that here you have a clock which is not in a church. In almost every town, the only clock is in the church. And here you have a clock which is not in the church. And this shows that at this time there was a conflict between the local bourgeois and the church. And that's the I mean, we're going to build our own clock. And that was really pretty powerful form. Of course, this is a modern photograph. Yeah? Yeah. Notice you have to be careful in the south of England. There's a lot of danger from terrorists. Yeah. There you go. Okay. So let's go back to the political history of Norman England. There were occasional revolts. In 1169, there was a revolt in the north. But most of all, with the changes in technology and the changes in society in general, the aristocracy were worried. The aristocracy were worried about the absolute power of the king. And so you see a long process where the aristocracy, they try to get more rights. And in particular, they want to have the rights... Well, two rights. First of all, they want to have the right not to be imprisoned just because the king wants to imprison them. And secondly, they want to have the right to talk to the king, to explain their interests and hope that the king will do something in their favour. they try then to oblige the king to follow some rules. And indeed, in 1215, there is the establishment of this document, La Grande Charte, the Magna Carta, which is signed by King John. This is a tremendously important document. Right now in London, there is an exhibition on the Magna Carta in the British Library. I do recommend you try to go to Britain. If you get up very early, you can actually go to London for the day and see a lot of things and come back and not have to pay for a hotel. It can be done. Or if you're feeling very energetic, you get the Eurolines bus all night and then you spend all day in London and then you come back. You're exhausted, but it's really cheap, like 60 euros or something. So the Magna Carta is a document which the aristocracy obliged the king to sign. And what is inside it? Some very, very interesting ideas. First of all, the idea of trial by jury. La première fois qu'on écrit l'idée qu'il faut un procès et des jurés, des gens ordinaires, de vos pères, comme on dit, jugez pas vos pères. And some of the sections of this document will be used again in the American Constitution and in the French Revolution. The king signed this, in fact he signed it with his fingers crossed behind his back. He was not intending to follow it, and the result was a civil war, the First Barons' War, la Première Guerre des Barons, the First Barons' War. Between King John and, I can't remember the other person, perhaps it was Matilda, I'm not sure. And the king was obliged to make some concessions, and indeed he agreed to organise meetings of aristocrats and bishops to advise the king. This is the very beginning of parliaments, that the king said, yes, I will organise a meeting every year, so that the aristocrats and the bishop, les évêques, can give me their opinions. So this is the very beginning of Parliament. Remember, of course, at this time, the Parliament is not about democracy. Democracy is an idea which doesn't exist at this time, although it will come back next week. So let's have a look then at the social structure of Norman England. At the very top, of course, the king, and underneath that, the aristocrats who can be barons or knights. That's also a bit of the Magna Carta. Indeed, this is the golden age of the knights. This is a French idea, the knights. This is introduced into England at this time. So all of these, you see these different symbols. You have a different symbol for each family. And if you go into the chapels and churches in England, you have all the shields with all the symbols. We stole the idea from the French. Yeah, we stole the idea from the French. This is chivalry. Chivalry, être chevaleresque. Here is the reality. If you were the youngest son of a baron, you would become a knight and you would have to fight. And you would receive from the king some land in exchange for military service. They were also an element of integration in the sense that many of the knights married English women. Can you imagine that? They had French women at home and they married English women. No explaining things like that. What the knights liked the most, of course, is the tournament, le tournoi, which is the popular idea. Tournaments were public competitions among knights. The first ever tournaments began in France in the 9th century, and soon afterwards the fashion spread to Germany and England. Sometimes there were 2,000 people in the knights, in the tournaments. Many people were killed in a tournament. Now, it's not so violent as the gladiators and the slaves of the Roman Empire, but nevertheless, it's quite a violent sport. This was controversial. The Pope in Rome, he didn't like the tournaments. Because the Pope wanted the knights to do something else instead. What did the Pope want the knights to do? The Crusades, les croisades. Yeah, the Pope wanted the knights to go and fight against the Muslims for Christian holy places in the East. Slowly the society is changing. For example, after a while, you see slowly the rise of money. So if you're a knight, you are obliged to do military service for the king. But after a while, the king said, if you don't want to fight, you can give me money instead. Yeah. In general, money was, this was the rise of money throughout the whole of the Middle Ages. This will take very, very, this will be very, very slow. This will be very, very slow. And very, very slowly, instead of, for example, if you have some land, you have your land, the Lord has let you have the land, and in return, every year you must work for 10 days on the roads, and work for 50 days on the Lord's lands. And this will decline very, very slowly over 500 years, and more, you must pay money for your land. Yeah, so this is the rise of money, extremely slow, and of course it will be, once it is victorious, money will dominate us for a long time. The forests are disappearing at this time. Agriculture is getting bigger and the forests are getting smaller, but they are still pretty big. At this time the wolves are disappearing. Les derniers loups en Angleterre disparaissent au 14e. Also the wild boar, le sanglier aussi, terrible. Now the forests are very, very useful for ordinary people, because if you go into the forest, of course you can get wood for heating in the winter, free wood, honey, there is no sugar, so honey is very important, and also deer, rabbits and fruits. However, it's dangerous because the forests belong to the king. And if you go and take things from the forest, you have to hope that the king's servants don't find you. Because, for example, if I find you stealing a deer for your family, then I'm afraid you will have to be executed. Yeah? You are executed if you are, you're hung if you steal a deer. This is interesting because there are many traditional songs in Britain. Songs which we discovered, which historians discovered in general in the 17th and 18th century, but which are very, very old, which sing about, you know, very typically a woman says, it's terrible because my lover is going to be hung because he stole a deer. Yeah. There are 100 songs about this. We also get the very beginning of enclosures. That is to say, at the time there is land which belongs to individual lords, and then there is quite a lot of common land, which you can use. And the common land is gradually privatized. Over 500 years, it is privatized. The technology is getting better, gradually you get the discovery of new vegetables. For example, they discover two vegetables, turnips and swedes, le navet et le rutabaga. These are very, very important at the time because they grow in the winter. And so you can feed your animals in the winter and you don't have to kill all your animals in October. Now, in general, we can say that the economic system is successful. Now, many people are very poor, there is often famine and so on, but nevertheless, in the 11th century, we have 2 million people, and in the 14th century, 5 million people. So, this is a successful economy. That the population is rising. Remember, of course, today when we say the population is rising, we say, "Oh, it's terrible! The population is rising." At the time, everybody thought this was a wonderful idea. So, if the population is rising, there are two possible explanations: either the agriculture was better, or the medicine was better. take it from me, the medicine was not better, okay, at all. It was a complete waste of time. In fact, medicine at the time was really not very good. Life expectancy, espérance de vie à la naissance. Vous voulez deviner? Oh, yeah, 31, very good, 31. Life expectancy at birth is 31. However, the most dangerous time is when you're a child. So if you arrive at 10 years old, then you will probably live to be 42. The first danger is when you're a small child dying of disease. Second danger another important danger, hunting and building. Very, very dangerous, yeah? Il n'y avait pas de comité d'hygiène et de sécurité au travail, for example. There was something which was more dangerous than hunting and more dangerous than building. Do you know what it was?
Fighting.
No, more dangerous than fighting. Yeah, having babies, yeah, absolutely. Childbirth, yeah. Very, very dangerous. Donc la mort en couche, comme on disait, la mort pendant la naissance d'un bébé, extrêmement courant. And so, between the age of 14 and 40, life expectancy was much lower for women than men. Remember the situation, you have 15 children and 8 of them die. Yeah? And so if you're going to have 15 children, then obviously it's very, very dangerous indeed. This was one of the reasons that quite a popular option at the time was to go into a convent. Vous savez que vous pouvez choisir de devenir bonne sœur et aller au couvent. Many of the people who went to join a convent was because they didn't want to die having 15 children. It was a very, very practical, material idea. They probably weren't more religious than anybody else, because everybody was religious. One of the terrible events of this time, so there's Sherwood Forest. I was talking about the forest, and there's Sherwood Forest, where the legendary Robin Hood was said to live at the end of the 12th century. Donc il s'agit bien sûr de Robin des Bois, who is at the time of... who's the king at the time of in the Disney story? King Richard? King John. King John, yeah, the bad King John. And the good King Richard, yeah, that's right, I remember now. Yeah. There you have the approximate population figures of the time. Of course, famine was a big danger, but perhaps even more dangerous at the time was the Black Death, La Peste. And when the Black Death arrived, this was really, really not good news at all. And the biggest of the plagues was in 1348. 25 million people died in Europe. 30% of the population of Europe. 30% of the population of Europe. And the same in Britain. This was a terrible experience for people because if you look here, you can see that these people have the Black Death there. They're not looking very well. And who's the gentleman behind them? Who is he? Jesus, no. It's not Jesus, no. It's a magician. A magician. Because although religion was important, magic was also very important. And he is being magic. He is being magic. It's not helping. Okay, it's not very successful. The Black Death was a terrible, terrible experience for people. But also, people believed it was the end of the world. Remember, people are very religious. The end of the world will come and Jesus will come to judge us. And people were absolutely convinced this was the end of the world. It's true, when 30% of the population die, if you're a religious person, you would be thinking this is the end of the world. Yeah. This led to some terrible, terrible events in parts of Britain and also in Europe, where people thought, well, whose fault is it? We have the Black Death, it's terrible. Obviously, God is very angry. Whose fault is it? And who do you imagine? Yeah, the Jews. The Jews. Donc, énorme massacre de Juifs en disant c'est la faute aux Juifs, forcément. Yeah? That's the. C'est une logique qui n'a pas disparu, hein? Pas tout à fait, on sait, ça va mieux. Hein? Terrible events like that. But also, a whole group of religious movements. Who said, you know, it is our fault. We are all sinners, and so we must torture ourselves to make things better. Again, this didn't help very much. So the Black Death now, the Black Death killed so many people that there were not enough people to work in agriculture. And so there was a good side to this. There was a good side to this. Every tragedy has one good side. And the good side here is if you were a worker after the Black Death, say, I want a higher salary. You can't have a higher salary. Well, I'm going to the next village then. They need workers. Everybody needs workers. There are not enough workers. And so salaries rose. So this is the good side of it. In fact, the salaries rose to such an extent that the king passed a new law to limit the rise in salaries. In 1351, he passed a law called the Statute of Labourers. Statute of Labourers, the Statut des Travailleurs of Labourers, which was the very first, we think, this was the very first law, at least in Britain, where the government, the king, passed a law about salaries. And he said salaries must not be higher than the salaries before the Black Death. Okay, it was not successful because the landlords were desperate, and so they continued to pay higher salaries. So these are the links that are going on at the time. This also led to a tremendously important revolt, which is still celebrated today. This is the 1381. This is in 1381. And 1381, this is the peasants' revolt, la révolte des paysans de 1381. And the revolt was against something called the poll tax. Now, be careful, because in history, poll tax has at least three different meanings. One in America in the 1930s, in Britain in the 1990s, but this is in Britain, in England in 1381. And the poll tax was the same tax. Everybody must pay the same tax. You're rich, £100. You're poor, £100. The same tax for everybody. There was a revolt against this, and it was a very impressive revolt, because of course today, if you want to organise a revolt, first of all you need your Facebook page and so on. At the time, it was much more complicated. It says, take a message to the next village. What message? Write it down for me. Oh, I can't read. Okay, so very, very complicated to pass the message around, yeah? The revolt began when one village refused to pay. In one village, they refused to pay the tax. The tax collector arrived, and they threw him in the river. It's a tradition. And the rebels from many, many villages, they marched on London. So they walked to London, yeah? That's why they walked to London. They arrived in London, and they broke into a prison, and they released... They released John Ball. John Ball was a radical priest who was one of the leaders. They went into London. They took the Tower of London. They found the Archbishop of Canterbury. They killed the Archbishop of Canterbury. And they persuaded the king to negotiate. Now, I think the king was about 12 years old, but he agreed to negotiate with them. But when the leader, Wat Tyler, when he went to negotiate with the king, the soldiers killed him. Never trust a king, yeah. Even if they say they're going to negotiate. So the revolt was, of course, crushed. But the revolt is very interesting. First of all, it's very impressive to organize a general revolt in a time when you have very few means of communication. But secondly, it's very important because John Ball, who was one of the leaders, was a priest, the radical priest. And today, we generally think today that politics is one thing and religion is another. But as I think I said last week, and I will certainly say again next time, at this time, religion and politics is the same thing. In a situation where everybody believes in God, then politics must be religious. If I say, I want a different society, my opponents will say, but this society is the society which God wants. And so I must say, no. I believe that God wants a different society. Yeah, the religious argument is obligatory. And I can give you an example, because John Ball, one of the quotations of John Ball is this: when Adam dalf and Eva span, who was than the gentleman? Now this is, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but this is in Middle English. Je traduis. Quand Adam creusait la terre et Ève tissait des vêtements, ils étaient où, les aristocrates? C'est-à-dire, votre idée de société, l'aristocratie tout en haut, c'est pas dans la Bible. Dieu ne voulait pas ça. On était tous les mêmes. This is a very typical example that the Bible is used as a support for radical reform. Now, today we find this a little bit surprising, because today, if somebody says, I think that society should be organized according to the Bible, then they are probably very conservative people. But at the time, this is revolutionary, because the establishment says, the king is the boss and the pope is the boss, and you're just little people. Listen to your priest, and the priest will listen to the bishop, and the bishop will listen to the pope, and the pope gets information directly from God. And so John Ball says, look at the Bible and you can decide what it means. And so the Bible at this time is a revolutionary force. And this is the best example, yeah? Aux origines, quand Dieu a créé le monde, il n'y avait pas d'aristocrates. Alors on a raison de se révolter et de tuer l'archevêque de Canterbury, etc. The other tremendously important movement at this time is that of Wycliffe and the Lollards, and they had many ideas about religion, but one of the most important ones is they said, here is the Bible. It's in Latin. Because it's in Latin, only the priests can understand it. We are translating this Bible into English. It's in English. Of course, many people cannot read, but in every village there is somebody who can read. And so we want the Bible in English. Now, as you can imagine, if you translate the Bible into English, you are executed, of course. They executed a lot of people at the time. Yeah. Because demanding the Bible in English is a revolutionary demand. Because it says, you don't need to listen to the priest. You can read the Bible, and the Bible will speak to you. And of course, the Bible is so successful and still very popular after 2,000 years, because it's full of many, many very different ideas you can choose. There have always been slave masters who defended slavery. We must defend slavery because it's in the Bible. And there were slaves who said, we must abolish slavery because the Bible says so. The Bible is very, very flexible. That is its historical force. The reason it can last for 2,000 years is because it's very, very flexible. And so the Bible is going to be important there. And I just have one last book I want to look at. Because next week we will, well, no, not next week, in 2 weeks' time, we will be looking at Protestantism. And the importance of the Bible for Protestantism, and the way that Protestantism for a short period of time was revolutionary because it attacked the old system. But for the moment, I just want to look at the Canterbury Tales, which is often considered to be the founding book of English literature. C'est à peu près... c'est quelle date exactement? La fin du 14e siècle. At the end of the 14th century, the Canterbury Tales. Ça veut dire que j'ai oublié la date. Okay, but it's the correct point, yeah? The Canterbury Tales, written by a gentleman called Geoffrey Chaucer. It's a very funny book. It's a portrait of society at the time, the Canterbury Tales. And we still read it today. And I could just give you a couple of examples. He is very mocking. When there is a monk and a friar... the religious people in his book, they are corrupt. And I could just give you a little example of the friar. A friar that was, a wanton and a merry, a liveter, a very festive man in all the orders four, is none that can equal his gossip and his fair language. He had arranged full many a mariage of women young, and this at his own cost. Je vous traduis quand même. Parmi tous les monastères, il n'y avait aucun comme ce moine-là. Qu'est-ce qu'il était fort en commérage, et c'était un beau parleur de premier. Il avait organisé beaucoup de mariages pour des jeunes femmes. Il insistait à chaque fois de payer de sa poche. Alors, vous êtes censé comprendre pourquoi il payait les mariages de sa poche. Hein? Qu'il les a mis enceintes et puis il a trouvé un paysan qui voulait bien se marier avec. C'est ce qu'il faut lire. So, a very ironic... Vous n'êtes pas rapide. A very ironic text. And the entire book is full of mockery of this sort. And it's a sign of a very long, very slow revolt against traditional church ideas, which I'll be talking more about next time, which will lead to an enormous revolution, the Reformation, which is a religious revolution, but religion and politics being the same thing, it will also change the possibilities for the future of Britain. Thank you for listening.